You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm Ankit Panda, your host, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I am Katie Putz, your co-host, also in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Katie, another week, another deluge of news here in Washington. How are you doing?
It was quite a weekend, but we will get into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So for listeners, we are taping on March 17th, and there's a lot in the news that we do want to come back to. This will be another episode in our continuing series on the second Trump administration and the broader geopolitical ripple effects. We basically have two agenda items for today's discussion, two things that don't really have a direct link to each other, but both that I think deserve discussion for their own merits on this podcast on Asian geopolitics, of course. So first, we're going to talk a little bit about the remarkable step taken over the weekend to essentially, via executive order, wrap up the operations of what for years has been a pretty important tool of American soft power, influence, messaging into various parts of Asia. This includes Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Radio Free Asia under the U.S. Agency for Global Media. And then we'll move on to talking a bit about arguably the big global economic story, which is, of course, tariffs and American plans there. But Katie, I want to turn it over to you. You've just written about this in The Diplomat. Tell us a bit about your thoughts on this. Where is this coming from, and what do you think the implications are going to be?
Yeah. So on Friday night, really, there was a new executive order, with a very anodyne title of "Continuing the Reduction of the Federal Bureaucracy," which targeted a number of small independent agencies. I have to note that these are not executive agencies. These are independent agencies. And so there's a legal question here about whether the president even has the ability to issue this order. But either way, the order essentially instructed these agencies to be eliminated to the maximum extent consistent with applicable law. That's a direct quote from the order. Now, how each of these agencies has tackled this has been different. For our purposes here, we're focusing on the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which until about, I think it was 2020, it had been known as the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the BBG, had gone through some previous changes. But it effectively serves as a parent organization through which Congress appropriates funds to U.S. AGM, and they fund outlets like Voice of America, RFERL, RFA, several others, particularly focused on the Middle East. The thing that brings all of these media organizations together is really a focus on freedom of the press and free media in societies that don't support it themselves. This is effectively the mission of RFE and RFA. VOA is a little bit different. Its coverage focuses on effectively explaining U.S. policies and U.S. positions toward the world out in the world. VOA does not target the United States with its coverage. It essentially is trying to be a voice for America, hence the name. What happened next was the very next day, U.S. AGM, which doesn't currently have a Senate-approved head. The Trump administration has nominated a guy named Brent Bozell, who is a conservative media critic, to lead U.S. AGM. He hasn't had a Senate hearing yet. And so all the other leadership sort of within that hasn't actually happened. But a woman named Carrie Lake, who is most famous for being a former TV anchor and a failed gubernatorial candidate, she has been made a special advisor. And so all of the talking points from U.S. AGM have been coming from her, and she's not actually in charge of this agency. She put out a statement and enacted policies that have effectively put all of the U.S.-based staff of VOA on administrative leave. So their operations, for what I know, are essentially frozen. The impact on RFERL has been a little bit different because their organization is a little bit different. Their headquarters are in Prague. The president of RFA or RFERL effectively came out and said, this order is a massive gift to America's enemies. Basically, what had happened was U.S. AGM instructed RFERL, sent them a letter that said, your grant has been terminated. So RFERL, and I assume this is true of RFA also, is funded via grant, via congressional legislation through U.S. AGM. When we can get deeper into sort of the results of that, but that's effectively what's happened so far.
Yeah, I mean, so look, a lot of great journalists out of work. I mean, these are people who are known to both of us. I think a little over a week ago, I was on Radio Free Asia talking about North Korea, and you know, it was good to know that what I was saying would go into North Korea, because that's one of the things that they try to do. And so, I think that comment that you just shared from the head of RFERL, that this is a gift to American adversaries, I think that bears digging into a bit, because I think this does take the U.S. government out of the messaging game in a real way, right? And what the U.S. has tried to do with the U.S. Agency for Global Media is very different from what, let's say, China and Russia try to do with their own state media, right? This isn't propaganda. There is still editorial independence and coverage. And one of the things that actually got VOA in the crosshairs of the Trump administration just a few weeks ago, when VOA's independent coverage was not deemed to be sufficiently pliant, according to the Trump administration, essentially. So I think there's multiple reasons that these organizations are in their crosshair. You also have a general hostility, I think, to the very idea of independent journalism in the White House. And so having these organizations, even if they do serve American interests, as I think they do, continue doing what they do, I just don't think that that was going to be something that they wanted to tolerate. And obviously, like, when you look at, you know, whatever rationale is being given, government efficiency, reducing waste, like, this is a rounding error in the U.S. budget, right? And arguably with a disproportionately favorable return for U.S. interests. But anyways, those are just my thoughts, Katie. I don't know if you want to add something to that.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the most remarkable things, so I go into more detail in an article that I wrote, and we'll link that when we share this podcast. But, you know, I looked at the statement that that is attributed to Carrie Lake that came out from USAGM over the weekend, and mm-hmm. It is absolutely wild. Like, one of the unfounded accusations, I would call them, that are listed in this is that, you know, this funding has been used to fund a quote product that often parrots the talking points of America's adversaries. Which is insane, because that's exactly what the administration is currently doing. It's unrelated to reality. And I do feel pretty strongly about this, because and anybody who's read my stuff at The Diplomat over the last 10 years, I have always drawn on RFERL's Central Asian services, because they're some of the only media outlets that are reporting in Russian and in local languages about domestic issues in Central Asia. And so a lot of the work that I have been able to do over the last decade has been built on that on the ground reporting by these folks. And it has been incredibly important. And it frankly, that media will not exist if RFERL goes away. And I think that's also true of, say, North Korea with RFA. You know, there are countless examples. The coverage of RFA of Xinjiang in the 2016-2017 period was absolutely groundbreaking. The coverage of RFERL in Ukraine in relation to the war in Ukraine is, like, massive. And so I think this, you know, it not to stress the point too much, because I don't think we can, it is a gift to America's adversaries. I've reported for years about how autocratic governments in Central Asia have problems with RFERL because they don't like the coverage. And now the U.S. government is saying the exact same things. Right. And it's pretty wild. And we'll see what happens. RFERL is clearly gearing up to fight this. I got comment from Lisa Curtis, who is, among other things, she's RFERL's board chair currently. She also, incidentally, was served in the previous Trump administration on the National Security Council as the director for South and Central Asia. And so she sent me comments this morning, pretty much backing up what the RFERL CEO had said, and laying out, providing information on the legal case that they're making that this is illegal. Congress has appropriated these funds, had instructed USAGM to use these funds for RFERL. They don't have a right to cancel to terminate that grant. We'll see how that plays out. I think it is worth noting, I don't know if we talked about it previously, but the National Endowment for Democracy went through a similar thing. They filed a lawsuit on March 5th, and by March 10th, their funding was unfrozen by the State Department, and they made the same argument that RFERL looks like they're going to make. So we'll see what happens. RFERL and I think RFA continue to produce currently, but there's clearly a target that has been set on them, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of the big picture here is that I think we mentioned this on previous episodes, or at least I think I did, you know, a lot of bells are being rung in Washington that are not easily unrung, and I think this is among them, right? I mean, even if we go back to business as usual, it's very difficult to imagine that you don't get a level of interference and hostility from the federal government towards these kinds of longstanding U.S. Messaging operations that are going to, I think, significantly limit just their effectiveness over the long haul. So, yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, that was a really important issue to, I think, talk about and to float for our listeners. The next one, I think, is going to be familiar to everybody because it's really the big global economic story, which is, of course, tariffs. I think the world has found out that, unlike maybe during the first Trump administration, you know, I mean, I say what you will about Donald Trump, but he's consistent on one question, which is he likes tariffs and he thinks that they are a solution for any number of economic problems that the United States faces. But I think the debate that has sort of now closed is, does Trump think of tariffs as leverage to get other things he wants, or does he see them as an end in themselves? And I think where we're ending up is in the latter camp, right? And I think that's really been a wake-up call, I would say, for many large, even corporate leaders who I think had the former interpretation of Trump's tariff interests. And so I think that partly explains just, you know, why you've seen kind of the American stock market and hence global stock markets, which are very much intertwined in the American market, take this huge nosedive. We're heading into now the April 2nd, I suppose, implementation of reciprocal tariffs. And there's quite a few implications, I think, for the broader Asian region, obviously. I mean, it's no secret for anybody that's been listening to our podcast for, you know, I guess 10 plus years that the U.S. has gradually been in the business of essentially disintegrating itself with Asia while continuing to trade, right? Like U.S. trade with Southeast Asia has grown disproportionately faster than China's trade with Southeast Asia, despite all of that. But I think the implementation of these tariffs is going to have, I think, big implications for a variety of economies in the region exposed to the United States, you know, everywhere from like Vietnam to Taiwan to Thailand, China, obviously, India, lots of countries that I think are going to really feel the effects of this. And it's going to just have a chilling effect on prosperity. I mean, just in Asia, where I think having access to the U.S. market has been a really important component of how many countries have thought about diversifying away partly from China.
Yeah, you know, and I think on this, the tariffs angle, one of the main features has been a degree of incoherence. You know, a tariff will be announced and then the next day it will be changed or walked back or adjusted. And so I think there's a degree of just confusion on the part of people involved in the various parts of the global supply chain, right? They don't know what the policy is going to be. They don't know what the policy currently is. And so I think that confusion really engenders a lot of this uncertainty and would arguably inspire companies and countries to sort of reassess some of those connections, because it's just the United States is no longer predictable. And that I think becomes difficult. I do want to also mention the OECD put out a quarterly report this week. It sort of forecasts growth in, you know, some of the largest economies in the world, and you know it has sort of ratcheted down the United States' growth figures as well as pretty much everybody in a way that is kind of worrying. I think we'll, you know, we have to also note when it comes to statistics and these kinds of things, we're only 2 months into this administration. And so I think the real economic impacts of tariffs on things like inflation, on job numbers in the United States, on stock markets and that kind of thing comes with a little bit more time. But the signs are not good. And you mentioned sort of the April 2 date. China also has sort of a date for its its retaliatory tariffs to go into effect. I think it's April 12th. And so in the next month or so, we'll start seeing how that goes. What is your sort of, I want to explore a little bit more, Ankit, where you think this leaves other U.S. partners, particularly the sort of the tariffs that the United States has enacted on its closest neighbors and closest allies, Canada and Mexico, and threats against other allies. How is that sort of interpreted in broader Asia among U.S. allies and non-allies?
Yeah, I mean, so I will say, you know, for allies like Japan and South Korea and Australia, Australia has already been in the crosshairs. Japan and South Korea have both already also been in the crosshairs in terms of, you know, Trump making comments about Japan standing next to Prime Minister Shiba about the way, you know, he's had longstanding views about Japan dating back to the 1980s when Japan was a big economic supposed threat to the United States, you might say, at least in Trump's view. So I think the answer to your question is really that, you know, it's the shoe that's likely to drop. I think one of the things that I think is perhaps most disturbing to a lot of business leaders who I think, you know, long used to tell themselves, well, you know, don't take Trump literally, but take him seriously. The tariffs are about leverage. Is the fact that Trump doesn't really seem to be sensitive to the stock market taking like a 10% dip, right? Because in the first administration, he was very concerned. He basically treated the stock market as a referendum on his popularity. I think he arguably cared about it more than he cared about actual opinion polls. And this time around, I think he's had a reassessment of that. There was actually an interesting bit in a New York Times story today where part of Trump's change of heart is apparently to do with the fact that Joe Biden oversaw a very good stock market, but still lost the election. And Trump said that if the stock market was actually a good indicator of presidential popularity, then Biden would be president, not him. And so I think something has changed. And I think that's really, you know, again, explains part of the reason we're seeing this kind of reaction coming out from just corporate leaders in the United States and elsewhere who I think maybe expected Trump to focus more on kind of some of the domestic culture war stuff, but maybe not so much on the tariff agenda, but it's kind of, it's all happening, right? And, you know, I mean, going back to this unpredictability point you raised, look, I mean, I'm just a humble podcaster, but, you know, I can't imagine that when you're trying to run a business and you're trying to plan your profits and losses, you know, knowing if you're going to be 60% up or 20% down because of government policy, essentially on tariffs, if you just don't know those numbers, it's just very hard to do any projections or planning or to even make new investments, right? I think it's likely to even chill new investment activity and sort of capital expenditure in the United States and elsewhere. So definitely an issue to watch. Not, you know, lots of kind of flashing red lights in the United States economically with lots of implications for the broader Asian region. But I think the closing note that maybe we can offer, Katie, is, you know, I remember in November, shortly after the election, I was asked by a colleague from an American allied country about how to think about what's likely to happen in Washington. And I think one of the things I said was that, you know, this is going to be a little bit out there, but I sort of borrowed the terminology of Freudian psychology, you know, the idea of the id, the ego, and the superego. And in the first Trump administration, you had a bit of the superego, right? You had traditional advisors around the president that made sure that there were still guardrails, essentially, on where things went. I mean, things still got pretty crazy, but we weren't sort of completely in uncharted waters. And what I said was, you know, the expectation this time would be that you'll essentially get Trump's pure id, like anything that Trump wants and feels is very likely to actually be transformed into policy because they've staffed up. They are genuinely pursuing a radical ideological project. And I think that's been actually a pretty decent bet. I wish I was wrong, but doesn't appear to be the case. I think with everything that we've just talked about, from tariffs to I think the broader re-architecting of much of the familiar tool set used in the broader project of American statecraft. So
yeah, and just to add to that, I had a conversation couple weeks ago, it was recently, with a Central Asian journalist who happened to be visiting Washington, and he told me, you know, he lives in an autocratic country. He said, "I think I understand your president more than Americans understand their president."
Yeah.
Because a lot of this sounds familiar to me, and you're all very surprised.
Yeah.
And so I think between the two of us, I think that's probably the way to think about this. You can't think too hard, because I don't know that there's a logic we're going to understand, but we will do our best to continue to cover it.
Absolutely. Well, I think we'll leave it there. And like I've said to listeners, we will obviously keep an eye on this story, which I think is still the most important geopolitical story, even from an Asian vantage point, the shifting role of the United States. But as we just did with our most recent episode on Duterte, we are still going to, of course, zero in on prominent news in the Asian region. So as always, if you have suggestions for us, please do drop us a note. We're very happy to take that into consideration. Finally, if you haven't yet subscribed to the show, make sure you do that so you can catch up with future episodes. And please also do leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate that. Thanks a lot for listening. And Katie and I will be back soon with more on the Asia Geopolitics podcast.